Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents Elmer Kelton's Sons of Texas series. Performed by Terrence Aselford, Drew Copus, Daniel Stevens, Andy Clements, Elizabeth Jernigan, Tony Nam, Joseph Thornhill, Michael John Casey, Thomas Keegan, M.B. Van Dorn, Richard Rowan, Joe Brack, Nanette Savard, Colleen Delaney, Michael Glenn, James Konacek, Tim Getman, Eric Messner, Dylan Lynch, Nick DePinto, Bobby Aselford, Scott McCormick, and Mort Shelby. Sons of Texas, number 2, The Raiders, part 1. Yesterday, nature had been quarrelsome. Dark and chilly clouds had scudded ominously inland from the Gulf of Mexico, threatening a drenching cold rain across the gently rolling prairie land and dense forests that stretched westward beyond the flat coastal plain of Texas. An angry wind had lashed the trees, whipping away new leaves, still the pale green of early spring. Michael Lewis had pulled his bay horse into the deep woods in search of protection, but the trees had offered only partial shelter from winter's final revolt against the changing of the season. He had slept fitfully last night, for an old nightmare he hoped he had finally put behind him had crept back like a thief in the darkness. He had awakened wide-eyed to the sound of his own voice crying out. Afterward, he had lain cold and trembling, trying to rewrap his thin woolen blanket around his shoulders in a way that would shut out the chill. But the chill came more from within than from without, and no blanket was thick enough to shield him from a memory too cruel to die. Today, nature smiled. The skies had cleared. The sun was pleasantly warm, and he had taken off his old woolen coat, a remnant of another time back in Tennessee. The wind had dropped to a soft and kindly breeze that carried the hopeful scent of new grass, the sweetness of wildflowers coming to blossom, and at times the slightest salty hint of the Gulf many long miles eastward. Michael had lived close to nature all of his 25 years. He accepted her blessings with the same equanimity with which he endured her torments. Nature had to be taken as she was, for nothing a man could do would change her. The works of men, however, need not be accepted without question, and Michael never had. So now he wandered here, far west of the American settlements, hoping the solitude would give him peace, would help him put down old angers, old ghosts. Michael Lewis was a tall man, with strong arms and shoulders, though he had a gaunt and hungry look about him, as if he seldom had enough to eat, seldom got a full night's sleep. Comfort was but an occasional acquaintance, and plenty was a stranger. From the hills of Tennessee to the first American colony in Texas, his next meal had often depended upon the long-barreled rifle he carried. He seldom failed to hit what he saw over the sights, but there were times the rifle stayed cold when game was scarce, and he found nothing at which to aim. The shadow of want was often upon him when he left home and hearth for the challenge of unknown lands. Days behind him waited his French-Spanish wife, Marie, and a young son Michael had named Mordecai after his father, long since buried. By now, Marie probably worried that he might have met with misfortune, for the few days intended had stretched to many. He knew he should be turning back, but the devils which had driven him here had come along with him, and he didn't know how to shake free of their torment. It had to do with this land, this Texas, which he had visited with the first Mordecai Lewis almost a decade ago. It had been a forbidden land then, property of the Spanish crown. No longer forbidden, at least by law, it could still at times be forbidding. This was a Texas which belonged to a newly independent Mexico, but had guardedly opened its doors to limited numbers of American settlers under a young Missouri impresario, Stephen F. Austin. An older Austin named Moses, who had lived under Spanish rule when Spain had owned Missouri, had appealed to colonial authorities in San Antonio de Bar. He had argued that despite its great size and potential, the interior of Texas had attracted only some 2,000 Spanish inhabitants. Even these few were constantly endangered by Indian depredation. As bad, or worse, were nagging incursions by illegal land seekers who restlessly pushed across the boundary from Louisiana. For a century or so, these had been mostly French. Now that the Louisiana Purchase had transferred a vast region to the United States, they were American in the main. How much better it would be, Austin had reasoned, that legal immigrants be allowed to establish a deterrent to the filibusters and illegal squatters, as well as placing a buffer between the few isolated old Spanish settlements and the Indians who roamed wild and free to the west and north. To that argument, he found Spanish ears receptive. If Indians had to kill someone, let it be Americans, the Spanish authorities decided. To Austin, once wealthy but broken by a national money panic, Texas had seemed a promised land. Like an earlier Moses, he had not lived to see his promised land become reality. His son Stephen, frail in body but possessed of a dogged patience and steely determination, had taken up the lantern lighted by his father's dream. It had been a twisting, thorny path. Just as the colony was driving its first stakes into the ground, Mexico had thrown off the domination of the Spanish crown and declared itself free, as the United States had severed its ties to England two generations before. The young Austin had faced the formidable challenge of doing over with the new government of Mexico all that he and his father had accomplished with the old colonial leadership. Through nerve, statesmanship, and a stubborn refusal to accept half a loaf, he had gradually established a friendly, if sometimes uneasy, relationship with at least some of the powers in Bar and Mexico City. He had been granted a region some 120 miles square, extending northwestward from the Gulf of Mexico. His old 300 colonists were firmly entrenched in this new land, mostly along the two major rivers, the Brazos and the Colorado. Others were gradually coming in overland and by sea, breaking the prairie sod, chopping away at the forests, transforming the wilderness into some resemblance of the places they had left behind them in the old states. Texas was accepting more and more newcomers, some under Austin, many under other impresarios who followed the path Austin had blazed. Part of what troubled Michael Lewis was this, for he had seen the same forces at work during his youth back in Tennessee. He had loved the woods and the wild open spaces, where a man afoot or on horseback could travel for hours, even days, and see no mark of another human. Little by little, he had watched the woods hacked away, the open spaces surrendered to the plow, the game decimated or driven off. Now those forces were here, repeating in this virgin land the pattern of the whole Western migration. And Michael, though he didn't like it, had been a party to the process. Back yonder, many days' ride behind him, he owned a grant of land, guaranteed by a paper which carried the flourish of Stephen F. Austin. Over the last 3 years, he had gradually enlarged his field, turning under the ancient prairie sod, bringing up the rich black soil built through untold ages of nature's annual cycle, growth, decay, and regrowth. He should be at home now, plowing out the winter weeds, planting the seed for a new year's crops. He knew many would call him an idler, a shiftless leather stocking tramping in the woods when good Christian men were at work in their fields, living up to their responsibilities. But in Michael's veins pulsed the blood of a father who had been a leather stocking in his own time, a product of the canebrake and wood, the man whose hands fit more easily upon the rifle than upon the plow. Mordecai Lewis had grown fitful when he spent too many days in the fields, too many nights within the confines of his cabin. His eyes would turn west, toward new lands that lay somewhere beyond sight. His westering days had brought him finally to a violent death and an unmarked grave in an alien country far from home. Yesterday, Michael had bent down over a clear running stream for a drink of water. The angular, bearded face he saw reflected back at him did not appear to be his own. It was his father's. That, as much as the oppressive weather, had been at the root of his nightmare. That and a small company of Mexican soldiers who had innocently ridden by Michael's farm. Their unexpected appearance had swept his mind back to another time, other soldiers. After a fruitless inner struggle to put down the ghosts, he kissed Marie and the boy goodbye and rode west up the Colorado River, looking for he knew not what. He was not sure he would even know it when he found it. He was at the edge of the wood when he saw the wolf, working a zigzag pattern through the old winter-dried grass, sniffing at the ground for scent of a rabbit or other prey. Michael's hand tightened instinctively on the long rifle that lay across his lap. Then it relaxed, for there would be no point in killing the wolf. It was too far west to be any threat to Marie's priceless little flock of chickens, or even to Michael's few calves. Here it could do no harm beyond that which nature had appointed as its duty, controlling the increase of prey animals that otherwise might multiply beyond the ability of the land to sustain them. So Michael felt no threat from the wolf, and saw no reason that he should be any threat to it. His attention riveted on the graceful movement of the gray predator, its coat still winter rough, its ribs spare of flesh because food had been scant through the cold months. The wolf caught his scent and jerked its head up, holding its nose into the breeze. Finding Michael, it stood still as a stone for a full minute, perhaps more, watching him. This was a region in which men, white men anyway, did not often invade. The wolf was probably accustomed to wild horses, so it saw the bay as no threat. It exhibited caution, but no particular fear. Curiosity satisfied, it went about its business of searching for a meal. Michael felt an instinctive kinship to the wolf, for at heart he was a hunter, a creature of the wild. Circumstances forced him to take on the trappings of the civilized man, to build his cabin and farm his land, to try to be a husband to his wife and a father to his child. But beneath the surface, fighting for escape, was a man who would be grateful to live in a state of nature if circumstances would but allow. The wolf moved on. Michael watched, hoping to see it scare up a rabbit, for he could feel its hunger, its need. He had a hunger of his own, a hunger civilization would not allow him to satisfy. He saw the wolf pull up short again 200 yards away, and he thought for a moment it had found the scent it sought. But the animal watched something hidden from Michael by a jutting edge of the forest. It crouched, retreated several paces, then halted to look again. Michael saw them as they came around the outer edge of the irregular wood. Half a dozen men on horseback. At a glance, he knew they were Indians. He had no idea of their tribe, for he had not seen enough of Texas Indians to have any clear notion of their tribal characteristics. It wouldn't matter anyway if they were of violent intent. Tawakani, Karankawa, Waco, or Tonkawa. One could kill a man as dead as another.
Might be Comanche.
Michael was far enough west to be in Comanche hunting grounds. That horseback tribe preyed mercilessly upon the Mexican settlers around Bar and beyond, but so far had professed a wary friendliness toward the light-skinned new American invaders, perhaps still trying to figure out just what manner of human they were. It was too late to escape discovery. Michael was 50 yards beyond the forest, and a sudden movement back to cover would only draw their attention that much sooner. Any defensive advantage the trees could give him would be temporary at best. He might just as well stand his ground. They had seen the wolf, but they drew their horses into a line and halted, watching the animal move through the grass. As it had done for Michael, it stopped and stared at them for a moment, then changed course just enough to angle past them without going into actual retreat.
Proud little bastard. Ain't just about to turn tail and run.
It had no reason to run. Michael had heard it said that most Indians held the wolf in some reverence. Many thought it a guiding spirit. Few would do it harm, fearing they might run afoul of some supernatural malevolence. The Indians watched the wolf until it had moved well past. Only then did one of them notice Michael, sitting on his horse some 300 yards away. The warrior raised a hand, and the others turned their heads. Michael trembled to a chill that ran down his back. It was a struggle not to turn and run. To do so would only ensure that they would come and take him. To stand defiant would require all the nerve he could muster from as deeply as he could reach, but it might also save his life. The warriors clustered together, holding a quick council, then surged forward, pushing their horses into a trot. They were a wild, barbaric sight, bows in their hands, feathers in their hair, jiggling up and down to the rhythm of their horses' movements. Michael lifted the long rifle so that they would surely see it. He checked the pan to be certain it held powder to set off a shot. One shot was all he would have time for. The Indian slowed and spread a little as they neared him. He continued to hold the rifle high, but forced down a strong impulse to aim at one of the riders. He pointed the muzzle over their heads. They halted at perhaps 30 paces. Their horses were curious about his bay, as the riders were curious about Michael. But the Indians did not move closer. They studied Michael with keen eyes, so keen that he had a feeling they knew he had eaten squirrel for breakfast. Michael heard them talking, though he had no sense of the words or their meaning. He couldn't tell whether they intended to declare friendship or to kill him. After a few tense minutes, they decided to do neither exactly. The young warrior in the center, who carried himself like a leader, rode a few feet beyond the others.
Hey, look! Come on, kid!
Michael had no way of understanding the Indian's words. It took all of his resolve not to lower the muzzle of the rifle and center it on a small leather pouch the man wore about his neck. At length, the Indian raised his bow to arm's length.
A shot, hook!
The leader pulled his horse about. As he rode through the ragged line, they turned and followed. Michael suspected they had intentionally put him through a test of nerve, and he had passed it to their satisfaction. After a moment, he felt his lungs ache and realized he was still holding his breath. He lowered the rifle and found his hands wet, his mouth dry. The wolf circled back toward him. Watching, he felt kinship again. He knew the Indians had felt it too.
Oh, brothers to the wolf.
It struck him that kinship to the wolf gave him a kinship to the Indians as well. He turned back finally and pointed his horse toward the settlement, dazed to the east. He would follow the river. He had been far enough west this time. There would be other times. The blue-speckled ox plodded with stolid patience to the end of the row, then stopped, waiting for Andrew Lewis to give the command to turn. But Andrew laid the wooden plow over on its side and stood a moment, wiping his brow, smelling the dampness of freshly turned earth, looking off across the rolling prairie toward a faraway log cabin. At this distance, he couldn't see whether smoke curled from the stone chimney or not. It was getting on toward the time for his brother's wife Marie to be cooking supper. He wondered if Michael had come home yet to eat it. He didn't have to look toward his own cabin, just up the long slope from the field, to know that its chimney yielded no smoke. No one was there to build a fire or to cook anything for him. He pondered the irony of it. Michael had somebody, but would not stay home to enjoy the warmth of her company. Andrew, 23 now, wished for someone like Marie, but had nobody. What was more, he saw no prospects. Marriageable women were scarce as gold coin in Austin's colony, and those few had bachelors lined up at their doors, handsomer and richer than Andrew Lewis. Well, richer anyway. As to handsome, that was a matter of a woman's taste. It had been a while since one had given him any indication that he qualified, at least one who measured up to his notion of a partner for bed and board. She would need to be somebody much like his brother's wife, and he had never met anyone quite like Marie. Maybe someday, if he ever got time, he would take himself a long ride beyond the Sabine River to the old Louisiana French town of Natchitoches. That was where Michael had found Marie. Perhaps there was another like her at home, as yet unclaimed. At least Andrew never had to worry about getting fat, eating his own cooking. Texas had lots of lanky bachelors. Now and again, when he was really hungry, he'd find an excuse to ride over to his brother's cabin and debauch himself on Marie's cooking. Being of both French and Spanish extraction, she had ways of fixing food unlike anything he had known in old Tennessee. She could make squirrel stew taste as good as roast beef pretty near, and do things with simple garden truck that even Andrew's mother back home had never thought of. The ox took a notion to shake itself, trying to ease the chafing of the heavy wooden yoke.
All right, Blue. We've plowed a right smart of ground today. We'll go to the house.
Andrew looked around for his dog, which had wandered away in search of a rabbit and had not come back. The fool dog would trot behind him back and forth across the field all day, watching for the ox and plow to scare up some edible prey like a rabbit or a wood rat, then disappear just when it was time to send him off to bring home the milk cow.
He'll wander into a hungry Indian out in the woods one of these days, and he'll wish he paid a little better attention to business.
Actually, Andrew had never run into an Indian in the woods himself. Though through the years since he had taken up this piece of land on the Colorado River side of Austin's colony, he had halfway expected to. Austin's people had been fortunate so far not to have had much serious Indian trouble, beyond some nocturnal taking of horses and mules, or the occasional ransacking of a cabin. Murder had been rare, but it was probably only a question of time. It didn't hurt for a man to have a rifle always within reach. The dog came panting up to the cabin about the time Andrew finished unyoking the ox and giving the big beast a fork full of hay. The ox would wander off presently in search of fresh green grass, but it would be waiting here in the morning for another modest bait of dry prairie hay. Andrew had conditioned it that way to structure its habits and give him control. He saw the reddish milk cow plodding in from the edge of the wood where the wide river ran deep and cold. Andrew had tried to condition her like the ox, but she possessed a more independent turn of mind, as if she knew how much he had to pay for her. He called her boss, for good reason. At least he wouldn't have to send the dog to fetch her this time. Boss hated the dog, which nipped at her heels when she tried to defy him. She would run at him, tossing her head and trying to dig him in the ribs with her short, curved horns. She had succeeded only once. That experience had had a salutary effect upon the dog's attention to duty. The dog and the cow eyed each other warily as she approached the pole pen where Andrew milked her morning and evening. The dog would end up getting half the milk because Boss gave twice as much as Andrew needed for drinking or cooking. That seemed not to mellow the dog's narrow opinion of her, however. He nipped once at her heels as she entered the open gate. She quickened her step.
Hickory! You come back away from there.
Andrew picked up a stick as if to throw it. The dog trotted off toward the cabin, totally happy with itself.
Darn dog.
Andrew forked the cow some hay to keep her in place until he could get back from the cabin with his milk bucket. He stopped a moment to look with a warm surge of satisfaction at his pole pens, his single-unit log cabin, his field, which he had expanded bit by bit, year by year. Everything here had been built or bought with his own sweat, along with some help from his older brother, Michael. He and Michael had often traded labor when one or the other had a job too large or too urgent to do by himself. Michael, being a married man, had been granted a larger tract of land than Andrew. But that was all right. Andrew's was more than large enough to meet his present needs. If he should ever find himself a wife, the terms of his contract with Stephen Austin were that he could acquire more land. What he already had was far more than he could have expected to acquire in a lifetime had he remained in Tennessee, instead of running off from home to tag along behind his brother. Andrew could not imagine willingly giving this up and returning to the old country, ever. He had been gone too long for Tennessee to be home again. This was home now. He had put his sweat and blood, his heart and soul, into this bit of new land. He would live here, and he would be buried here. God and the Indians willing, he would be an old man when that happened. Finished with the milking, he found the bucket nearly three-quarters full, far more than he could use or the dog needed. He remembered that Marie's best cow had dried up, pending her freshening with a new calf, and the young heifer serving in her stead probably gave only about enough milk to fill a fair-to-middling coffee cup. If Andrew started now, he should reach Marie's cabin just ahead of supper time. He did not particularly relish the idea of eating his own cooking tonight anyway. A man took his excuses where he found them. His brown horse had ambled up to the pens just behind the cow and stood waiting in the hope that Andrew might be generous with that hay, kept tantalizingly out of reach behind a sturdy rail fence. Andrew slipped a bridle over the brown's head and got a sad look of betrayal.
I'll feed you when we come back, Brown. Right now you've got a little job of work to do.
Andrew had never given the horse a better name than Brown for its color, but he felt it was at least a slight step up from simply calling it horse. The animal was strictly utilitarian, lacking any strong individuality that might give rise to a more imaginative appellation. He did what he had to, and no more. He had even less personality than that blue ox. Andrew saddled up. At the cabin, he cut down a quarter of venison that was likely to spoil before he could get around to eating all of it anyway, and he picked up the bucket of milk. He wished he had something more practical to carry it in that would not allow half of it to slosh out on the way. But the necessities were hard to come by in colonial Texas, and luxuries, like a good metal container, were out of his reach. He had seen Mexicans and Indians carry water in goatskins and the paunches from cattle, but he reasoned those were not the proper vessels for milk, at least not if he was taking it to Marie. Though she had learned to be a good pioneering woman, able to do with a little and make it seem a lot, her Louisiana upbringing had been more refined than that. The brown horse had an easy gait, so Andrew managed to keep most of the milk in the bucket. He lost a little of it crossing an arroyo, and a little more when the brown horse took it in his head to jump a fallen tree rather than go around it. A black and white spotted dog came up as he approached. The young woman stepped out into the open dog run that separated the two sections of Michael's and Marie's log cabin. One hand held a rifle, the other shaded her eyes. A small boy clung to her floor-length homespun skirt, peering around her in shy curiosity. Andrew felt his heart rise as he rode toward her. He had always thought Marie an uncommonly handsome woman. He always wished he had seen her first. A glimmer of disappointment showed in her dark eyes.
From the sun you came at me. You looked like Michael.
Impatience tugged at Andrew as he thought of his brother leaving this woman and boy here alone. If Marie were his, he would never leave her.
Hasn't he come home yet? I'd have figured he'd be back by now. The field over yonder needs to be getting seed into the ground.
He was in, a state of something when he left here.
Something of a state.
Andrew frowned, assuming that Michael and Marie had argued.
It was the soldiers riding by. That is what did it, I think.
Soldiers?
Mexican soldiers. Their horses. They watered at the river. They were friendly. They did not seem to want anything. But just to see them, Michael was much nervous. Soon, then, he was gone. We know, you and me, what is his trouble.
Andrew nodded grimly. Brother Michael displayed little fear of the world's traditional hazards. Man, beast, or weather, he took them in stride. But Andrew could remember times when they had lived and traveled together that Michael would awaken in the night in a cold sweat, trembling from a dream. He would seldom talk of it, but Andrew knew where its roots lay. Years ago, when Michael had been but 15, he had followed his footloose father Mordecai on a horse-gathering trip west of the Sabine River at a time when Texas belonged to Spain. Grasping adventurers and power-seeking filibusters had made Americans extremely unpopular, subject to summary justice. When a troop of Spanish soldiers caught up with a little party of horse hunters, a vengeful lieutenant ordered them slaughtered like cattle on the open prairie. The officer had blown Mordecai Lewis's brains out. Michael was wounded and left for dead. That Michael was back in Texas a decade later and settled down to stay seemed remarkable to Andrew. The political climate had changed, The Mexican government was at least guardedly hospitable to American immigrants, so long as they minded their own business, pledged allegiance to their new hosts, and showed no inclination toward lawlessness or rebellion. Itself having been born of rebellion, the government of Mexico was particularly sensitive to any sign of discontent among its subjects, lest history repeat itself. Michael had seemed to have no qualms about embracing that government. He held Spain, not Mexico, responsible for the killing of his and Andrew's father. But the sight of dark-skinned soldiers in uniform still opened old wounds, unlikely ever to heal. Marie smiled tentatively as she looked up at the bucket in Andrew's hand.
For strawberries? It is much too early.
Marie's smile could turn a man's heart to butter.
Milk. My old boss cow is fairly spilling over because of all this new spring grass. Thought you and the button might have some use for it. You don't mind a little weedy flavor.
It will taste fine. Get down. I will fix the supper.
Oh, I wouldn't want to put you to no trouble.
No trouble? Maybe Michael will come.
Andrew smiled. He had always liked to listen to Marie talk. The accent was not enough to get in the way. It was just enough to play arrestingly upon the ear. Leaning from the saddle, he handed her the bucket, then swung to the ground and untied the venison.
Put your horse in the pen and give it some hay. I'll go in and get started on supper.
Andrew took a little time, feeling awkward about being here alone with Michael's young wife when Michael was gone. It was not as if anything untoward was going to happen. Even though he was strongly drawn to Marie, to act upon those feelings was unthinkable. It was the appearance that bothered him, however innocent the reality might be. Michael would think nothing of it, but some people in the colony were given to talk. There were people everywhere who would talk, whether there was anything to talk about or not. Little Mordecai stood on the dog run and watched his uncle with big and curious eyes that reminded Andrew of his own small brother named Jonathan, left behind in Tennessee. The Lewis stamp had always been strong. Andrew suspected that as this boy grew older, he would take on his grandfather Mordecai's gaunt and rangy look. All the Lewis male offspring did. He tousled the boy's long hair.
Oh, another year or two, youngin, and you'll have to learn to follow plow.
Plow.
Mordecai pointed toward the field. The boy was always initially shy when Andrew came over, but he never remained that way for long. He warmed quickly to company.
I may have to come plow that field if your daddy don't find his way home pretty quick.
It was in his mind that some misfortune might have befallen Michael, but he regarded that possibility as remote. Their father had been an outdoorsman, never so happy as when he tramped the woods, preferably alone. Michael was in many ways his father's image and unable to change the legacy. Their mother had often taken the responsibility of organizing the farm work and parceling out the tasks to her young sons when Mordecai forgot to come home from the forests. Now Michael's Marie was following the same pattern. But little Mordecai was several years shy of being able to take on the work. Before entering the cabin, Andrew walked to the woodpile out back. The stack was large. Michael had dragged up deadfall timber from the forest during winter's lull, but only a little of it was chopped into short lengths for the fireplace. Andrew picked up the axe, looked around to be sure the boy was not in harm's way, and then set to work. He took out against the axe and the wood the anger he felt against Michael. A few chips bounced violently off the log wall of the cabin.
Andrew! Supper!
Marie had sliced a little of the venison he had brought and made some cornbread and warmed up a pot of beans. He would have liked coffee, but that was a luxury. Texas settlers often parched grain as a substitute for coffee beans. To Andrew, it had always been a poor replacement. He'd as soon drink plain water, and did. After sating his first hunger, he paused.
Oh, it's awful good, Marie.
Your venison. For some days we are out of meat, except for the ham in the smokehouse. That I only take a little, to make it last.
If I'd have known, I'd fetch you something. I'll make a little sachet out in the woods tomorrow.
You should do your plowing while the weather is good. You should not bother about us.
No, he would agree. He shouldn't. And he wouldn't have if Michael stayed around like a good husband. But that was Michael's way, and nothing would keep him from roaming except a crippling accident, or worse.
You don't need to be worrying about the weather. Old man Willett is something of a weather prophet. He says we're fixing to have a good spring.
The old man Willett always says it will be good weather. When it is dry, he says it soon will rain. And when it rains, he says soon the sun will shine.
Marie pushed away from the table and walked out the door to the dog run. She stood with arms folded, brow furrowed, and stared toward the dark line of forest that lay to the west, as Michael remembered his mother doing many a time. Marie had eaten but little. Andrew was mildly ashamed for having eaten so much. One piece of cornbread remained on the plate. The boy Mordecai looked longingly at it, but was too well trained to reach for it so long as someone older sat at that table. Andrew pushed the plate toward him.
You better eat this before that spotted dog comes in here and steals it.
Andrew walked out onto the dog run and joined Marie. Marie's sad eyes indicated that she knew Michael was not coming.
Maybe he'll be back tomorrow.
Perhaps. I did not want to tell you, but I should, I think. Three men came yesterday looking for him.
What men was that?
They did not say their names. They said they knew Michael back in Tennessee. They were a rough-looking lot of men.
Did they say how they knew him?
They said only that they were old friends and neighbors. They kept asking which way he had gone. I told them west of here is very big country. They said they would be back.
They knew Michael in Tennessee. They knew me, too.
They talked about Michael only. They said they were his friends, but they made me nervous.
What did they look like?
Tall men, thin, bearded, about the age of you and Michael.
Was a one-armed man amongst them?
Oh, yes, it is true. One of them did have a sleeve pinned up.
Blackwood!
Marie had heard Michael and Andrew speak of them.
You think so?
Andrew nodded bleakly and stared toward the dark woods, wishing Michael were here. He had not thought about the Blackwoods in a long time. He and Michael had assumed they put the Blackwood trouble behind them years ago when they left Tennessee. But that kind of trouble seemed to follow a man like a hungry wolf sniffing out tracks.
Which way did they go when they left?
East, toward San Felipe. They said they looked for land. They said soon they will be Michael's neighbors again.
Like hell they will.
Andrew picked up his rifle and started toward the pen where he'd put the brown horse.
Where do you go?
To San Felipe to see Stephen Austin. If I start now, I'll be there in the morning. If Michael gets back before I do, you tell him about the Blackwoods first thing. Then you can take time to kiss him.
Riding in the darkness, Andrew startled some wild animal which broke for the nearby brush. It must have been a deer, though he never got a clear look at it. He found his heart thumping, his hands slick on the stock of his rifle. It could as easily have been the Blackwoods setting up an ambush. That would have been their style. Generations later, Texas would know them as bluebonnets. But these blue and white wildflowers had not yet acquired the name. Riding his brown horse toward the village of San Felipe de Austin on a trail not yet old enough to be deeply beaten out, Andrew Lewis knew only that they were one of the most striking sights he had ever seen. Even in his weariness from riding all night, he was able to appreciate their beauty. Their early spring splendor was like a reflection of the morning's open sky, a brilliant blue carpet spread almost solidly across the hillsides and down into the valleys, broken here and there by newly leafing trees and bushes, some of which had blossoms of their own to provide a counterpoint in color. Now and again, the blue weave was interspersed by yellow buttercups and by blazing orange skeins of another wildflower similar in height. In a sense, these blue flowers were like Texas itself, new and fresh and unspoiled. They would run their course much too soon, the blossoms drying and dropping away, leaving a coarse and nondescript weed, like a beautiful smiling girl who turns much too quickly into a nagging and unappealing old crone. But while they lasted, they lifted his spirit and made him glad he had followed his brother Michael westward into Texas. It was a raw country, yet long on hardship and privation, short on prosperity and comfort. But if its weeds could bring forth such blossoms, even for a little while, then surely this stern and still rugged land should be capable of a gentle and generous side to its nature. It had, up to now, been generous with its wildlife, its bounty of fresh meat to help put food on families' tables until they had time to break out their land and lay by a crop or two. Were it not for deer and squirrel, fish and wild fowl, Andrew and Michael might not have survived their first 2 years. But now, as more and more people took up parcels of land in the region the Mexican government had allotted for Austin's colony, Andrew sensed that the game was thinning, killed off or scared away into remote regions not yet familiar with the strike of the axe or the bite of plowpoint into primeval sod. Most settlers, including Stephen Austin, seemed to feel that this was the way it was meant to be. The destiny called for the wilderness and all that went with it to be pushed steadily westward until it ran out of room and out of existence. Andrew felt himself partially inclined toward Austin's view that the land was meant to be tamed, that the wild forest was to be converted to fruitful fields, that the wild animal was to give way to the domestic beast, that civilized man was meant to live from his own cattle and hogs and chickens, not by the hunt for the native white-tailed deer that multiplied and consumed the land's bounty, and too often contributed not to the welfare of man. Nature was not to be accommodated. It was to be overcome, for only thus could the multitudes be fed. Andrew had no fear of the multitudes. It was his nature to be gregarious, to enjoy company and laughter and song. But another side of him felt sympathy for his brother's far different view. Michael was uncomfortable wherever there were many people. He loved the forests, the unaltered prairies. He had a respect that bordered on worship for the wild things of the earth and sky, while he had what amounted almost to contempt for the cud-chewing cow, the rooting pig, the ever-dependent sheep. Andrew saw futility in that view, even while he acknowledged the validity of it. Like it or not, people would keep coming. Their ever-expanding numbers would need fields to provide them with sustenance, homes for shelter, roads to grant them passage, grass and water for the domestic livestock which provided their walking commissary. The Indian had made little demand upon the land, had altered its face virtually none at all. But the white man's way was to take whatever he found and restructure it, to bend it to his own needs, his own dreams. The Michael Lewises of this world would never stop that process of constant change. They might as well try to stop the wind. Andrew's stomach growled, for normally by this time he had eaten his breakfast and had been at work in the field for an hour or more. He had paused only once in his journey, at the cabin of the Willett family, some miles east of his own. There he had shared a quick cup of parched corn coffee and a story or two with old man Willett before traveling on. Given congenial company such as that, he would have been happy under normal circumstances to have spent a day or two. It was in Andrew's nature to laugh, to sing, something Michael had never learned. San Felipe de Austin, some 70 miles inland from Galveston Bay, could hardly claim to be a town, not in the sense of towns Andrew had known in Tennessee. Village was more like it, though if one counted the many farms which clustered close around, the total population would have amounted to much more than the small settlement revealed at first glance. In the Mexican style, it boasted a small square bearing a high-sounding name, Constitutional Plaza. But the plaza had far more huizache trees around it than buildings. Most of the stores and houses were strung in a random manner along a road that paralleled Palmito Creek. Timber was plentiful here, so most were constructed mainly of logs, American style. A majority were built on about the same rough utilitarian plan as those Andrew had known in Tennessee. Double cabins, like Michael's and Marie's, with an open dog run in the center and a single roof joined in the two sections. Or a single cabin like Andrew's own, which could easily be expanded into a double cabin if the right girl ever smiled at him. There was little about San Felipe to indicate that this was part of Mexico. It was totally unlike the town of San Antonio de Bar, which he had found to be in sharp contrast to anything he had seen elsewhere. Bar was unlike even the northernmost Mexican town of Nacogdoches, Texas. And Nacogdoches was different in many ways from its sister city, Natchitoches, across the Sabine in Louisiana, despite the similarity in names. Each had a personality uniquely its own. San Felipe, except for the Spanish name and what passed for a plaza, appeared to be simply an extension of the old states, an American island in an alien sea. to the occasional Mexicans who visited, it must have seemed as strange as Barr had been to Andrew. But he had found something intriguing about Barr, almost magnetic. Perhaps Mexican visitors to San Felipe knew the same feeling. The new and unknown tended to have two sides, like a coin. One bringing apprehension, the other an exotic and compelling attraction. There was nothing about Stephen Austin's office to mark it as different or better than other structures in this village on a bluff above the wide and muddy Brazos River. There was little about Austin himself to mark him as wealthier or living any better than the colonists who depended upon him for leadership, except that he had the general look of a tradesman or merchant rather than the rough and weather-worn appearance of a farmer. He customarily wore homespun to avoid giving an impression that he felt himself above those in his community who could afford no better. His double log cabin, shaded by a huge moss-strewn oak, served as both residence and working quarters. Andrew tied the brown horse, then walked up the foot-packed path toward the cabin. Two men burst angrily through the door and down from the dog run. A burly young man was a step or two in the lead, a dour gray-bearded man behind him. The young man, in his haste, bumped hard against Andrew, causing Andrew to falter and fall back. The man turned with blazing eyes.
Why don't you get the hell out of folks' way? You seen me coming.
The man acted as if he intended to pursue the matter with his fists, and Andrew raised his own in self-defense. But the older man gripped the younger one's arm. Andrew saw thunder and lightning in the creased old face.
Come on, son. Let us be gone from this place.
The younger one seemed inclined to stay and pursue his grievances, whatever they were. But the old man hustled him toward two tied horses. Andrew watched them ride away. He thought the old man's back was straighter than the young one's. Whatever had made him angry had done a thorough job of it. When the pair had traveled 50 yards or so, and he was sure they were not coming back, Andrew walked to a well in the yard, rocked up to about waist height.
Help yourself. Water is the one thing which we have in plentiful measure.
Stephen Austin stood on the dog run, watching him. Andrew turned the windlass and studied the man as he filled the community dipper from the wooden bucket. Austin looked older than his early 30s. He was thin, almost emaciated looking, betraying in his spare frame little of the inner strength that had enabled him to build this American outpost in the midst of an untouched wilderness, that had made it possible for him to deal on the one hand with leather-clad frontiersmen who in some instances could not write their own names on the deeds he prepared for them, and on the other to fit into the highest courts of Mexico, fighting his colonists' cause with the vigor and resolve of a missionary zealot. Andrew and Michael had met him in Nacogdoches on the brink of his first great adventure into Texas. Other would-be land impresarios had tried to duplicate what Austin had done. Most had fallen by the wayside. Austin's eyes burned with a fire that said he would die before he would retreat. Andrew measured all men by his brother Michael and by the memory of his father Mordecai. Physically, Austin stood in their shadow. But in spirit and determination, he would have put them to severe test.
It's good to see you, Andrew Lewis. But I'd like to think you'd be at home, taking advantage of this fine spring weather to get your planting done.
I've been working on it, but something come up.
Whatever it is, it'll look better over a cup of coffee.
Andrew followed the impresario into the office side of the cabin, where the coals of a burned-down fire still glowed beneath a blackened pot. Austin poured coffee for Andrew and refilled his own cup. Andrew savored the coffee's aroma. Real coffee was an indulgence he reserved for special days, and there were not many of those.
Them fellas that just left here, they weren't in too good a humor.
I just refuse them land in this colony. I don't believe they're the sort we want.
Who are they?
The old one is named Tolliver Beard from Louisiana. The other is his son. Their reputation has preceded them. Beard is a contentious old man who would bring nothing but discord to this colony. His son, Jace, is just a brutal lout with no sense of propriety. I told him not to come back.
I'd as soon not see them again.
Andrew studied a hand-drawn map stretched across part of the log wall. Idly, he ran his finger from San Felipe past several dozen other land holdings to the pair which bore his name and Michael's. They were among those farthest west. That had been Michael's doing, a legacy from their father Mordecai. Mordecai's eyes had always been set on something farther west.
You indicated trouble. I hope no one is ill. Perhaps your sister-in-law is with child again.
Not that I know of. I'm already an uncle once. But in a way, this concerns her. There was 3 men come by my brother's place while he was gone. Caused Maria a mighty worry. I wonder if you've talked to some fellers named, Blackwood?
As a matter of fact, I have. 3 brothers from Georgia, they said. No, Tennessee. They asked me about taking up land, and yes, they asked about your brother Michael, and they said they knew him.
They know him, sure enough.
I would surmise that it's not a friendly acquaintance.
Yeah, they're a shiftless family. Only thing they ever worked at was mischief. Reason Michael come to Texas in the first place was, he knew if he stayed any longer, sooner or later he'd have to kill one of them, or they'd kill him.
More than that, though Andrew saw no need to burden Austin with the details, had been Michael's fear that the Blackwoods and their determination to get at him would hurt others in his family. Finnis Blackwood had wounded Michael's uncle Benjamin by mistake, trying to hit Michael. Andrew thought it best not to mention that. Austin had gone to considerable lengths to avoid accepting violent men and leather stockings among his colonists. He had probably suspected more than once that Michael belonged in that class. By extension, Andrew would also fit the category.
I hope you're not granting them land.
Austin shook his head and almost spilled his coffee.
I made up my mind almost on sight that I would find reason to pass them by. They didn't appear to be the sort to fit in with my old 300. And the fact that they said your brother was a friend of theirs gave me some pause about him. That he is not their friend comes as a relief to me.
It'd be a relief to me if you could chase them plumb back to Tennessee.
Under Mexican law, I am the alcalde here. I have considerable police and military power, but that power extends only to the borders of this colony. That's as far as I could push them, and even then, I probably wouldn't have the authority to do so until and unless they break the law.
They will, sooner or later. It's born in them, I reckon, like it's born in a fox to steal chickens.
Austin's face was creased with concern. To him, this colony was his life, and the people in it were his family. Even if a few became errant now and again, or resented him out of a false perception that he was becoming rich on their labor.
One of my requirements for land claimants is that they bring proof of good character. Letters of reference or recommendation. The Blackwoods had none. If they appear again in San Felipe, I'll request that they depart this colony forthwith.
Request? Andrew wondered what Austin could do if they refused. This colony was so law-abiding that as yet there had been no necessity even to build a jail. The nearest he knew was a Mexican calabozo and bar, a long way for anybody to be obliged to ride with the Blackwoods as reluctant company.
If these men appear again, tell them I wish to consult with them. The problem will be out of your hands.
They may not want to come.
I've always suspected that your brother possesses strong powers of persuasion. I imagine that some of his determination runs in your blood as well. Just see that you don't spill any of that blood in the process, will you please? Violence disturbs the Mexican authorities and bar, and it does my digestion no good either.
Austin did not invite Andrew to stay for dinner. By the thin look of him, Andrew suspected the man might not be eating regularly anyway. The work and worry of the colony overrode his sense of comfort or even of physical need. He was one of those people who stopped to eat only when the notion struck him. Other matters took priority, even over concern for his own health. Andrew could put aside considerations of comfort when the need arose, but he was not immune to fatigue. The coffee had temporarily overcome his hunger, but he felt the weight of the night's long miles bearing heavily upon him. More important, he knew the brown horse did also. He followed the wagon road down to the bluff and lingered to watch the ferry which operated between the 2 banks of the wide and silt-laden Brazos. Sleepiness soon overcame his curiosity. He rode up to the river away from the noise of human endeavor. Andrew staked the brown horse on new grass and lay down in the benign shade of a towering oak from which the moss dangled like an old man's long beard. Andrew opened his eyes and found himself the object of interest for a couple of lean hounds of a bluish hue, a kind favored by coon hunters back in Tennessee. One of them backed away cautiously, but the other continued to sniff at Andrew's legs, probably picking up the scent of Andrew's dog Hickory.
Sorry if my hounds woke you. They got no more manners than a brush hog.
Andrew rose up and stretched, facing a farmer probably 10 or 15 years his senior. The man rode a black mule. Behind him, astride an old plow mare, came a boy of 10 or 12. He drove half a dozen cows, three with calves trotting beside them. Andrew had seen the man around San Felipe. This was probably his land.
We come out to gather up our stock. Didn't figure to gather up no company. Your name's Lewis, ain't it?
Andrew Lewis. Rode all night. Just let my horse rest a little before I start home.
Yeah, and I always like to see a man who watches out for the welfare of his animals.
The man pointed upriver with his chin.
Time we get to the barn with the cows, a woman will have dinner ready to put on the table. We'd be pleased to have you join us.
Oh, I'd be tickled.
Andrew rode along beside the man, complimenting him first upon his strapping son, then upon the fruitfulness of his cows. Besides the three which had already calved, two more would obviously yield their increase before the bluebonnets lost all their blues. The farmer acknowledged that five out of six wasn't bad, but the dry cow had cost him the most.
Yeah, a man doesn't always get what he pays for.
The man's fields were well plowed, the rows straight as a rifle barrel, and they were pole-fenced to keep the cattle from getting in. The log house was long, three rooms at least, with a sturdy clapboard roof. The whole place showed the mark of a good and industrious manager, the kind Austin had sought for the nucleus of his colony. As they drove the cows and calves into a pen and closed the gate behind them, the two men and the farmer's son went inside for the meal. The fare was simple, all home-raised, but it was plentiful and filling. Andrew sensed the contentment of the farmer and his wife, and watching them reminded him of the missing element in his own life, of the empty cabin to which he would return.
Well, if you don't mind me saying, sir, you sure do have a handsome family.
There were three children younger than the boy who had ridden the plow mare, all sitting at the table.
Yeah, that's what makes the work a pleasure, Andrew, having somebody to share the fruits of it with. Can't be much in it for a man who don't work for nobody except himself.
Andrew's mind drifted to Marie.
Not what there ought to be.
Now, we done well here in Texas. Got more land here than we ever could have got back in Georgia. There, it was mostly all took, and too high for a man ever to buy and pay for. We only broke out the smallest part of this so far. Time the boys come of age, they can each parcel off for their own needs, and we'd still have plenty. Yeah, Austin's been real good to us.
Well, the Mexican government's been good to us.
That was the first time he saw the farmer frown.
Yeah, but it's a foreign government. We're Americans. That's the only thing which don't quite set right with me. They're good to us now, sure, but what if they come along someday and see what we built and decide they want it for themselves? They ain't our people, and we ain't theirs. They won't have any deep compunctions about trying to take it away from us, I'm thinking.
They've promised us solemn.
Well, the bunch that's in has promised us. Them people down in Mexico, they're everlastingly fighting among themselves. What if someday a bunch takes over that won't honor the promises? What do we do?
This was not the first time Andrew had heard that question asked. He had no answer.
We fight is what we do. That's all we can do.
Maybe it'll never come to that.
The farmer slapped the flat of his hand against his stomach.
Well, I got a feeling in my gut, and it's a fair-sized gut, as you can see, that it will come to that. Now, maybe not tomorrow, maybe not next year, but someday. And not even Mr. Austin will be able to stop it.
Andrew started toward home after the best meal he'd eaten in days, his stomach satisfied, but his mind in turmoil. The farmer had started him thinking about questions that had risen periodically from his subconscious and that he had forcibly put aside. It was a long way south to Mexico City. Who here could really know what was happening there? And how many men were harboring the same suspicion of the American colonists as the colonists harbored about them?
They ain't our people, and we ain't theirs.